Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve Chaney, the CEO of the American Security Project. And in our continuing series on national security, today is a particularly unique one, the Battle on the Final Frontier, a discussion of national security and space. Let me talk for just a second about the American Security Project, founded in 2005 by Kerry, Hagel, Hart, and Rudman. The intent was to bring up topical issues from a nonpartisan perspective. And in particular, he wanted the national security side of it and do it factually. So he put together a board, an equal number of Republicans, Democrats, businessmen, and women, and then added 7 or 8 flag officers, 3 and 4 star, who would lend the national security perspective to all these issues, among them climate change, nuclear security, energy security, asymmetric operations, and terrorism, and American competitiveness. We've been hot on all those issues ever since. We've had some phenomenal successes, not the least of which we put in a lot of work to the New START Treaty, and we like to feel we helped get that passed. So today I want to talk a little bit about space and our reliance on other technologies and the implications for national security. And I've got a couple of really great gentlemen to talk about it. And first up will be Lieutenant General Sipe, former commander of the 12th Air Force, an Air Force Academy graduate. He's commanded 2 squadrons, an operations group, a wing, and also an exchange tour with the Navy, I understand.
Raj.
How many cat launches?
202.
202 cat launches. Well, God bless you, you're still alive. More than 4,500 flying hours, primarily in fighter aircraft, flew the F-15 in Operation Southern Watch, Northern Watch, and Iraqi Freedom. Was the deputy for Combined Forces Air Component Commander for Central Command and participated in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, as well as Joint Task Force in the Horn of Africa. Now, following General Sipe will be August Cole, who's one of our fellows. And August is a former Wall Street Journal reporter. He's been reporting on national security issues for about 2 decades, has written extensively for us. From 2007 to 2010, he was a reporter on the defense industry for the Wall Street Journal. And I love this. He covered companies ranging from Boeing to Blackwater. So you've covered it all, I know, on the defense side of the house. He's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and has a master's degree from the JFK School at Harvard University. So with that, General Sipe, let me turn it over to you for a couple of minutes. And what we'll do here is I'll have each one of them do comments for 4 or 5 minutes apiece. We're going to have a general conversation. When they're done, I'll open up to Q&A, and it's a structured Q&A. We are blogging this. We are tweeting it. We're also recording it, so it'll be up on our website this afternoon or probably tomorrow morning, in case you don't want to take notes. And it is all on the record. So with that, General Sipe.
On the record, I didn't know about that. Steve, thanks for the invite. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being here today. You know, they say there is no free lunch. Well, today there is a free lunch, okay? So enjoy it. Looking forward to the questions. I am, as a reminder, just a product of the New Jersey public school system, so go easy with me on the questions there, but it certainly is a pleasure to be here and talk about this topic. As Steve mentioned, I've had the opportunity to work twice in an air operations center. An air operations center at the operational level warfare, meaning that we do C4I. We do command and control, computers, communications, and intelligence at the operational level of warfare. So I would submit to you that as an AOC commander working for 2 combatant commanders, as well as in my past 4 years, I've worked part-time for the Air Force, and I go to the air operations centers around the world and watch the combatant commanders exercise. Let me tell you, space is taking a forefront in all the combatant commanders and all the components that are associated with those combatant commanders. You know, we've had unfettered access to space probably since the day we showed up there and basically kicked the Russians out of orbit and started doing our own business there. But I would submit to you that space has become a contested environment. It's a competitive environment and one that we need to be concerned with. And what do I mean by that? Well, for the past 12 or 15 years, we've had, unfair use of space. We go where we want to go. We launch when we want to launch. We do what we want to do up there. But it hasn't been too long ago when the Chinese decided to get involved with space with their ASAT experiment, which was, I guess, very successful if you looked at how to clutter up space there. And if you look at some of the recent things they are doing in space there, you and I can figure out very quickly. They're looking at other orbits that they could potentially play in and impact our ability to do that business. All our enemies out there, potential threats out there, are looking at places where we either have an asymmetric advantage, which I would submit to you space is, or where they can take away our asymmetric advantage, where space is. And if you throw or overlay cyber over this, I would submit to you that there's non-state actors that are going to get involved in space just because they can from a cyber realm as far as impacting our business in space there. But let me just talk a little bit about where I want to go with this. You probably ask, what's the tie to national security? Well, in my mind, and in the mind of many of my contemporaries out there, retired flag officers, as well as current flag officers out there, national security is about options, meaning the right options, and about choices, meaning good choices. So when you have to rely on Russia for a critical element that allows us to get to space, and that being the main engine of one of the Pentagon's key space launch vehicles, I'd submit to you it's not a very good option, nor is it a very good choice to have when your provider, the Russians in this case, in my opinion, can turn the tables on you by taking away or severely impacting your option or your choice. Case in point, if you look at the report, you don't have to look any further than the Crimean Peninsula and the lockdown that's occurred by the Russian forces there. Now, is it time to go to battle stations? Is it time to man up our weapons? No, we're not there yet, and I doubt if we will be. But don't all of you here today find it just a bit disconcerting as our report states that on one hand, Russia's supplying the U.S. with critical technology and hardware for our military satellite launch program, while on the other hand, it's actively working on technologies, anti-satellite technologies, along with China and a few other less than neighborly nations designed to destroy or degrade those very systems. Like I said, I do, and again, I'm just a graduate from the New Jersey public school system. You folks around the table are a lot smarter than me, and I'm sure it's not lost on President Putin that the very U.S. satellites that he's helped launch are now monitoring his troop movements. They're gathering intelligence. They're monitoring his communications. And the intelligence that we're gathering from our satellites that he helped launch, we're sharing with our European allies out there and other nations out there. So in my humble opinion, it's time to look at options and choices that involve our own technologies, involve our own industrial base, so we can better assure our ability to operate in the space domain and respond very quickly and decisively to emerging space requirements that aren't dependent on someone else's goodwill, someone else's political or economic agendas, or someone else's cooperation or technology. And to me, that's how we keep America safe and secure. That's how we stem the tide of our shrinking industrial base. That's how we grow back our technological superiority. And to me, ladies and gentlemen, those are two good options, and those are two good choices. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to August. And he's the proud author of the report out there. And August, over to you.
I was going to say, I failed to mention that this morning, August Cole has come out with a report on national security and American space challenge. You can pull it up on our website and read it. So with that, we'll turn it over to you, August.
Thank you, Steve and General Sipe. You know, I don't have the aviation experience of General Sipe. I did have a beautiful flight in on JetBlue from Boston today. And that actually, I think, is an important point in that, it's easy to overlook space, and space is a national security issue. In Washington, we tend to look at a lot of these issues as front burner priorities, but for much of the country, we don't. And it's easy to see why. You live in a city like D.C., you don't see the stars. It's not much it's not partly part of our kind of daily ritual experience to look up and wonder, what is up there? What are we doing up there? We take it for granted a little bit. But space matters. It matters more than ever, especially to the military, as General Sipe said. I think this paper and this event, thank you for coming, and hopefully for reading the paper as well, or at least download it. It's part of the dialogue that ASP works toward in terms of improving public understanding. We have critical issues that often don't get enough attention. I think General Cheney's work on environmental security with Andy Holland are a good example of that. And this is very much in that line. We're looking to create consensus around the importance of military space access. And this has a great hook, as General Sipe said, because of the situation in the Crimea with Russia. I think in the importance of a space-based intelligence gathering, we know that it's crucial, not just in the tactical context, but it also provides information that shapes our strategic understanding of the world we live in. And that means advance notice of troop movements, or it means intercepting military communications. That's just undeniably important. And it also leads us to this moment, too, when we look at how the military space industrial ecosystem functions. One of the ways that I've looked at such issues like American competitiveness is not only in analyzing what makes us strong, but actually what makes us weak. Where are our vulnerabilities? It's easy to talk about what makes us strong. That's usually what most people like to do. But it's often missing the opportunity to take action in fixing something that should be addressed. And that means, in this case, looking at our industrial base, how we actually get some of our nation's most vital assets into orbit. It means also really assessing whether we're doing enough for research and development, both in the military and in the civilian sector, around space launch. You know, clearly, there's an abiding need that is developing, and it's something that policymakers need to be even more attuned to. You know, when I was younger, I used to read a lot of science fiction, and then that tapered off and was replaced by history or political science. I felt like I was just growing up and shouldn't read it anymore. And now, as I'm getting old, I feel that science fiction actually has a great role to play in understanding how we look at some of the possible worlds that we may inhabit, not necessarily today, but in a few years out. I think that's, in fact, one of the most important things we can do in terms of having this dialogue and this conversation that really starts here today, is using our imaginations to understand that the assumptions we have about the reliability of our space assets may not be as strong as we think. It's clear, you know, DoD knows this is an issue. They're working hard to address all aspects of it, even the launch side, as General Seip pointed out, of the Russian role. Competition's coming, and there will be more, but there always can be more that can be done. One of the things I think that we often see is that the version of competition in Washington is different than the way the rest of the economy, both in the U.S. and globally, works. And I think it's time to kind of integrate some of those practices and attitudes more into the way we do military procurement of all kinds. You know, the Budget Control Act, too, is forcing hard choices throughout the Pentagon, throughout Washington. We're seeing the aircraft that the Air Force flies put in more and more hours. Space satellites are having a similar situation where they're being kept in orbit for longer and longer, really as long as is possible. You know, the aircraft that refuel many of our fighters are often older than the pilots. The satellites aren't quite that old, thankfully, than some of the engineers maybe who are working on them. But the paradigm is there, and it's a significant one to understand if you're thinking about it from an adversary's perspective and where America's vulnerabilities lie in space. The evolution of the industry, though, is happening apace, whether the DoD is part of this or not. Satellites are getting smaller. The Air Force is trying to look at this in a more contemporary perspective and talking about what's known as disaggregation, meaning using more satellites with fewer functions. The idea that if you lose one, you have more to another one to replace it, or you can put another one in orbit more easily. But as it is, we're very reliant on heavy lift, putting big satellites atop big rockets and getting them to orbit as quickly as possible. It's become very expensive, and the cost control measures that are put into place are having an effect, but not enough to make this a viable prospect in the coming decades. And so overall, I think that means looking at the commercial market in a new light, in satellites, in space launch. We're going to see increased competition. It's going to come. It's going to happen. I think that's just the way that policymakers are going to keep pushing, and it's important for DoD to get ahead of that. I think the way we're relying on the Russian engine for our EELV program is a sign of some of the old ways of doing things. And apart from that world, there's a new ecosystem, economically speaking, that's emerging that is potentially more attractive from a military perspective, but also a taxpayer perspective. I think that's something that we're going to be increasingly sensitive to in terms of getting value per dollar when we look at even our most exquisite assets, like some of the space technologies that were talked about earlier. In a sense, you know, we're looking at a paradigm shift within the defense industry, too. There are a lot of big existential questions about how big the companies should be, what businesses they should be in, who should own them, shareholders or private entities. There is a lot of opportunity within that existential moment to think about the kinds of business and the way we do it. And space launch is one part of that larger debate, that larger exploration, but it's one that I hope you can participate in with us here today. Thank you.
August, thanks. Great comments. I've got a lot of questions, so let me just start a quick dialogue and ask you a first one, General Seip. I think it wasn't that long ago we weren't that dependent on satellites, but today, look at GPS, for instance, and other technologies that were, I think the average American just doesn't totally understand how dependent we are on satellites and on space. And then when you draw that line into the defense realm, how much is our defense establishment dependent on what's orbiting around in terms of C4I or reconnaissance? How important are those assets to our national defense?
Yes, Steve, obviously very important. You know, in that air operations center that I referenced to, what's important to us in space? Global weather. for planning and for execution. Precision timing, precision navigation for those GPS type of bombs so we can minimize collateral damage, so we can get the effects that we want with minimum use of resources out there. For secure comms, when you look at the fact that we're flying UAVs in Afghanistan and a few years back in Iraq and controlling them at a base in Nellis Air Force Base, there's over 135 touch points that go from the place where that young man or young woman is controlling that UAV to the actual flight of it there. And a lot of that is over the secure comms that we hope are secure that we need to have mission assurance for. And then finally, certainly the intelligence that we get from overhead imagery, whether it be from the NRO or our own services as far as what they put in the sky there. So very dependent on it. It gives us an asymmetric advantage. It gives us that global view. It gives us that God's eye view of the commons out there. And certainly one that's not lost upon, you know, potential threats out there as far as, you know, how do we take away the United States military's information superiority, their decision-making superiority. Well, if I was the threat out there, I'd be going after those command and control nodes that basically are hooked into our space assets that allow us to have that OODA loop. You know, if you want to go back to John Boyd as far as being able to quickly outguess your enemy, know more, act faster.
Yeah, I'm no expert on satellites, but, you know, when you look at what's gone on this last couple of weeks in the search for the Malaysian airliner and then all the different countries that have satellites up there that have coverage over the world now, they haven't all launched them. They probably paid to have somebody else launch them for them, much like we're paying Russia to give us the engines to launch our own. It's just astounding to me, the proliferation of satellites and what's up there. But how vulnerable are those? If, for instance, and I'm not advocating a weaponization of space, and I'm sure I know there are treaties against that, but if somebody did an electromagnetic pulse up there, could it knock them all out?
It would, depending on what it were, but, you know, you put that type of pulse at, you could have a pretty big effect, not just on the military, but what you and I do each and every day as far as banking and commerce and whatnot there. So it'd be a wide range of effects out there from just a simple pulse or what have you. You know, look no further than the Chinese, whether you believe what they say or not, that they weren't trying to weaponize space there, the fact that they, you know, caused a collision between two of their satellites there and put a lot of junk in space that we are tracking for the rest of the world ought to make it be a little bit suspect of their intentions both now and in the future there. I mean, their doctrine is one of deterrence. Deterrence, when they do it, is a show type of deterrence, which is they act on what they have a capability of, where the United States and other of our partnered allies like to do a lot of writing, a lot of discussion about what we think we're going to bring to the table without showing our hand. The Chinese are not afraid to show their hand, as well as other nations out there, from a deterrence factor.
Not to get into anything classified here, but if somebody did something like that, what's our capability for reconstituting the spectrum that we've got up there?
It's a laborious one, unless we had a lot of lead time, knowing that we were going to face contested airs or contested space, that we could, you know, line up our Atlas and our other type of launch vehicles out there. And as we know, you know, some of our launch vehicles are dependent on other people's technologies, other people's licensings, and other people's goodwill, not to mention the economic impact there. So we don't have lots of rocket boosters just sitting on a pad or sitting in a warehouse somewhere waiting to be rolled out. As August said there, the type of vehicles we're putting into space right now require large type of rocket bodies there. They're costly, and right now, with the budgets the way they are and what we've built, it's, some of this is just-in-time type of capability sure. That we put up there.
You know, August, I talked about the proliferation of satellites, the number of countries that have satellites up there and the other countries that are launching them. How did we get ourselves into the fix of almost total reliance upon the Russians for engines for our satellite launches?
I think a lot of the, there's different forces at work. You know, when we talk about the globalization of the defense business and the defense trade today, you know, that's a paradigm that is real and it's happening. We're seeing it in the way the Pentagon buys its weapon systems, and I think more importantly from the way they look at it within the Pentagon itself, but also on Capitol Hill, we expect allies to buy our weapon systems. This is different. This is not that natural progression and sharing among allies. This was something that in its origins made a lot of sense at the time, because the hope was that you would be able to employ Russian rocket scientists, and the Russians are quite good at building these big liquid-fueled engines, liquid propellant engines. And the idea had been to produce those in the U.S., and that hasn't come about. And so that gives us an opportunity to really think about, is this the way we want to keep going? Is the way we're building satellites, not just today, but in the future, going to need the kind of sustainment of a kind of business-as-usual approach to this sort of heavy launch? I think there's a real opportunity to examine that and to have that debate both in the Pentagon but also on Capitol Hill, as a lot of the constituencies have a lot invested. There's a lot of effort that's been put in to get the costs down on the part of that program that should be lauded. But I think the times we're in may require more, and I think that's some of what the debate needs to be. Again, not just in the context purely of space, although that's what we're here to talk about, but I think if you really want to see this as part of a larger trend that's going to be playing out in the next few years over the budget cycles, whether we have the Budget Control Act or not, that you're going to see a real need to take cost out in a way that, that hasn't been, I think, fully appreciated yet. And that's going to mean people being creative, and that's a very hard thing to do in Washington sometimes.
Yeah, with the demise of the space shuttle, we're totally dependent on Russia for manned launch to get people up to the space station. But we don't have to be totally reliant on their engines to launch our own satellites. Is that correct?
Potentially. The idea would be to have DoD look at more entrants in the market and to open this up in a way that might fund R&D in the sector. I mean, when you step back and look at the top research and development expenditures by company globally, there are no aerospace and defense companies in that top 20. And I think when you look at that kind of a shortchanging of future investment, you start to then, therefore, flip that around and look, where are the opportunities to try to make progress and get that dollar back into engineers in the U.S. working on programs that are going to have a direct impact on U.S. national security?
Yeah, great answer. With that, I'd like to open up to Q&A. And the way I kind of want to do this, if you have a question, just raise your hand. We've got a roving microphone that we're going to use that so we can record it. So I think these have been pretty stimulating conversation here and some good questions. I'd be interested to hear what you all, if you have a comment or a question, and we're very interested. Anybody have something that's pressing on your mind you'd like to ask these two experts or us? And Sam, I see you right there, so wait for the mic, and here we go. Please tell us who you are first.
This is, I'm Sam Brown. I'm with the American Security Project. Given that our satellites are likely to be prime and urgent targets in any major future war, what are then the necessary and best counters to the anti-satellite capabilities of potential enemies? I mean, it seems to me that there are a range of possible counters. Some, of course, are diplomatic, like mutual forbearance of deploying these capabilities. But if indeed countries go ahead and deploy anyway the anti-satellite capabilities, what is our most effective response? Is it counter-deployments of ASAT so that we work toward a kind of a mutual assured satellite destruction relationship? Are there other capabilities, such as arming satellites? But what is the thinking now in military planning circles about the best counters to that ASAT threat?
I'll throw that one to General Sipe.
Yeah, and I'll walk that fine line so I don't roll into something that's classified or, you know, that I've heard at a war game or what have there. But, you know, a couple of things come to mind. One is this idea of resiliency, disaggregation, going from big to small, that you can, you know, throw more up there, have it less costly to be able to launch, actually be able to have satellites made it in the bin, so to speak, on the bench, ready to go if, in fact, we find ourselves approaching a conflict where we think space is going to become an issue there. Again, we have not, as a country, stepped forward and said we're going to, you know, weaponize space there. So I certainly don't want to go there, but there's certainly policy issues that need to be discussed. You know, what is a hostile act in space? What is hostile intent in space? We as airmen, we as soldiers, sailors, Marines, we understand, you know, in our land, maritime and air domains, what hostile intent, hostile act is, but what does it mean in space? What does it mean to, you know, take a defensive countermeasure? You know, when do you decide that something's really coming after me and I need to move my satellite? And if I move my satellite and it's on a commercial satellite, what does that mean to the stakeholders out there that are, you know, potentially, or the customers out there, they're going to lose some capability because of that movement of that satellite. And what happens if we move the satellite so many times because we think we're being threatened that we basically use up all the onboard type of fuel there, and now the threat out there has accomplished the same goal. It's got a dead satellite up there that I can't use there. So there's lots of talk out there about how to, I won't say how do we not weaponize space, but how do we take care of ourselves up there to ensure that both the civilian or commercial users out there as well as the military users out there have some way of, I guess, for lack of a better term, surviving. And I think a lot of it comes down to space situation awareness. How do you get space situation awareness as far as what's going on out there? How do you figure out maybe left to launch what that potential person or country or state actor is doing vice after it's already, you know, heading into orbit and making its movement there? And do you have the space situation awareness to be able to dope all that out and make some type of proper military and or economic type of decision as far as what you're going to do with your satellite? Wow. Now, it's a long answer to a short question.
August?
It's a great question, and I think there's a couple interesting dynamics there. One is the rapidity with which you could lose space assets. It may be happening before you even really realize it. And that puts you in the position of thinking as much about not only the response, but how do you replace that capability? And so that speaks again to some of the thinking that's going on in the Air Force about can we do the same thing with more satellites that are maybe less costly or simpler to protect against that kind of an outcome. The other element, though, and I think, again, the Russian example in the Crimea is very interesting. You know, here you have an incursion that is short of what we might acknowledge as a conventional invasion. A shot was not fired. Those kinds of operations are possible in the space and cyber domain. You know, you may lose accuracy on a certain satellite's systems, GPS, for example. Can you ascribe that to an adversary in the Pacific as you're maybe squaring off over a box of the ocean? Possibly, possibly not, because there is such a murky legal framework around what is permissible and not, what constitutes conflict in space and what does not, that you run the risk of escalation in a way that could be very, very perilous for two parties. But also, it would be very difficult, I think, within our own decision-making system in Washington here to plot a course of action. And to some extent, you might be picking up the pieces. And therefore, it comes back to that question of having a rapidly replaceable capability that you can put back up there, ideally with another satellite, but using UAVs. There's other options that the military has toyed with a little bit to kind of figure out the fast response. But the long-term question of replacing destroyed satellites is ongoing.
Great question, Sam. Yes, ma'am, over here.
Hi, I'm Melissa Hirsch. I'm a risk analyst, and I flew in late last night after 3 weeks in the Middle East, so if this is incoherent, my apologies. I was really glad to hear you bring up space situational awareness, because that was one of my questions, and I have three. One was, how does disaggregation impact space situational awareness, and what role does the commercial sector play with respect to that? So you have the SDA database as well. How is that going to be shared with in the space situational SSN as well? How is that all going to be put together in the future? So I think I have four questions. The other one is, this discussion has predominantly been focused on DoD, but you've been talking about resilience and vulnerability, and this is a critical infrastructure conversation. So what role does DHS play, if any, and or any other fora for addressing critical infrastructure protection? And what, in your mind, is the difference between disaggregation and multi-mission assurance? And how does that include the commercial sector? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for coming, ladies and gentlemen. No. The answer to the first one is it makes it harder, obviously. If you're going to disaggregate, you're going to go smaller, much more out there to put your capabilities on more satellites and different capabilities on more satellites. Obviously, from a space situational standpoint, you better have the technology and capability to be able to track all that and then understand. I mean, you got to know yourself and know thy enemy, know thy threat out there. You got to understand exactly what you're asking for when you do this idea of disaggregation. And I know Air Force Space Command, and I'm sure the Joint Staff, OSD, and many others out there that make a lot more money than I ever made are thinking through that as far as it's an easy term to throw out. It's an easy thing to write papers about as far as how great disaggregation will be. But it comes with a whole set of problem issues, just as you mentioned there. How do we track all that? Again, I'm not so sure that we have all that technology. I think a lot of it's going to be looking for other partners out there to get involved in that, because I mean, we spend an inordinate amount of time, you know, just focus on what's up there right now floating around, whether it be junk or actually satellites, and we are basically the watchdog for the entire world out there. We call everybody when their stuff's getting close to someone else's stuff, or we think something's going to happen there, to include folks that aren't necessarily our best neighbors there, because it makes sense, because you know, if you sit there and go, I don't like that guy, I'm not going to tell him his stuff's about to hit someone else's stuff, you know, you're basically going to, you know, cut off your nose to spite yourself there as far as garbaging up the orbits up there. From a commercial sector, at least the discussions I've been involved with, they are obviously worried about more things up there, having space situation awareness for their customers, for their stakeholders up there. I think they're particularly concerned when they have military riding on their satellites, as far as what's that mean to their customers and who's going to take the risk, and what are the some of the policy issues, you know, who's responsible if something happens to that satellite? Is it DOD? Is it the is it written into the contract as far as how much risk the commercial side's going to take by allowing you know, the military to ride on some of their backbone there? And then the last portion that you talked about as far as, you know, this whole idea about more focus on the commercial side, absolutely. Again, not pointing to any particular companies out there, but those that I saw at a recent seminar at Air Force Space Command are, in some cases, I think, further along than DOD as far as thinking through this program, as far as how they're going to operate in space, have mission assurance, which is a big word, as far as to guarantee that they can deliver to those customers down there, because if they can't deliver, there's other companies out there that people can move toward there. So, again, a lot of, at least I was exposed to a lot of good discussion with the uniform folks as well as with the commercial side of the house there as far as what does this mean as we roll into the future there. How did I do a handle on? That's, I probably missed a couple of your questions, but I'll turn it over to
I can't top that, but the framework I think that's important, too, is that there's a business case that has to be made when you're looking at this from a corporate perspective, whether you're looking at whether you're going to carry a DOD payload or not. You know, I don't think any CEO these days is interested in sort of science fair projects for their own sake. I think there has to be a real rationale to deliver some kind of return, and it's one of the challenges. But the flip side of that, again, is that you have to find ways to make those sorts of on-ramps if you're looking to entice commercial providers into any of the federal, you know, procurement opportunities. Is how do you cut red tape? How do you reduce their costs so they're not burning through their budgets just trying to fill papers and not do the actual engineering that makes a difference and improves U.S. national security? So I think that's an important part of what you're asking, too, and it ties into infrastructure, I think, as well, because that is absolutely a commercial and government dialogue that's happening now, but is part of whatever we do in the future. Thank you.
I'm not sure what DHS's part in this would be. I've been through airports a lot in the last couple of months. I'm not sure I want them messing around with satellites if they have a hard enough time in the airport counters. But I view that as kind of a secular domain of DOD. Would you not, Norm? I mean,
yeah, I would think that NORTHCOM is spending time talking to their civilian counterparts at DHS to be able to understand, you know, the whole scope of the potential problem out there and the threats that both the we as a country with our own infrastructure might face vis-a-vis just, you know, what DOD is concerned about from a national security standpoint. I would submit to you that when we start talking about our own infrastructure there, that's part of our economic security, which that certainly ties into our national security. So I don't think you can divorce one from the other. I think decisions made in one area, you need to, before you make that decision, you need to think through the impacts it's going to have, you know, throughout that whole space structure or system that you're, you know, looking to impact or affect.
The one question, and thank you for your comprehensive responses, but the really fundamental actual emergency response capabilities are something I've read very little about. So I'm not just concerned about cyber disruption. I'm also concerned about actual detritus falling from the sky and or problems in space. Addressing how to reconcile those issues. When we talk about resilience, but what does that actually mean? I mean, this may be a conversation that's taking place before the technology exists to make those decisions, but who's actually discussing that? Is DOD discussing that?
They are. I would tell you that STRATCOM, Air Force Space Command, Army Space, and others, Navy, all the services are thinking through this idea of, you know, how are we going to survive in space? How are we going to continue to use space to be our asymmetric advantage and not have it taken away from us? And if it is taken away from us, what does that mean from a risk standpoint? How do we work around that risk? What does it cost us? And what does that mean then from the entire infrastructure that we need to put in place, both in space and on the ground, in order to support a disaggregate type of setup, if in fact that's the way we decide to go?
Great question. Anybody else pressing with a question here? Paul.
Paul Hamill from ASP. The reliance we have right now on the Russian engines, what does that mean for our national security now, and what does it mean for Russia?
Well, I'll just go back to what I said. You know, to me, that's a bad choice, and that's a bad option. And in the military, when you only have one choice, you really have no choice. And I'm sure that applies to the civilian world out there also. So I would submit to you that we ought to look for other options. We ought to not necessarily look just at licensing or trying to get a license to manufacture. So we ought to look at our own technology, our own industrial base. And then obviously, I realize we're all, again, where we're going to spend the next dollar. But as August has talked about in his paper there, we need to think through what's important to us as a nation as far as not just surviving tomorrow, but surviving out into the future as far as being, you know, a world leader in the economy, in you know, basically securing our nation, keeping our men and women, our families safe and sound there. So to me, a dollar spent in research and development, a dollar spent in our own industrial base, a dollar spent on our own technology, I think pays huge dividends down the road there. The trouble is, as we all know in this day and age, when someone hands you a dollar from the hill, they expect something back, you know, the next day. They're not interested in the 10-year return or the 20-year return or something nebulous like national security. So it becomes an effort on everyone's part to try to educate and make that case that, you know, I may not be able to give you the dollar back tomorrow, but I may be able to pay you back in many different ways down the road there.
If I could add, too, I think there is, you know, a simple way of just following the money and watching it, you know, move through a relationship that puts that money into Russian accounts. I think given the bigger challenges that we have in the U.S. around a dwindling number of big and arguably exciting aerospace engineering programs that are tied to DOD, you really have to take every chance you can to keep as much of that in-house, if you will, as possible. I think there's a larger sense of mission that goes with working on space projects. I think that's true for aircraft, too. But people react very emotionally to a lot of these programs, and that's a very subjective thing, I realize. But when you're talking about, you know, drawing the next generation of engineers into programs where they're looking on big integration challenges, again, there are not a lot of opportunities to do that. And every technological piece we're talking about here is part of a bigger ecosystem, and that is really important to keep that ecosystem healthy. And that's really what our taxpayer dollars should do.
You know, could you not actually compete this out and do it cheaper?
The DOD has looked at competition in the way they are running their current heavy lift, and they're looking at ways to do that as well. And I think, again, this goes to the bigger question of what is the value per dollar?
Sure.
And that's often hard to understand when you're working on some of these programs. They can get very opaque, and again, the red tape and the paperwork that goes with competing can get really, really serious.
Question down here on the left.
So building off that previous question.
And you are?
Oh, sorry. Rafael Perino, I'm a graduate student at the Space Policy Institute. Building off that previous question, I was recently watching a Senate hearing in which you had Mike Gass from ULA, Dr. Scott Pace from the Space Policy Institute, and Elon Musk from SpaceX, and they were talking about the RD-180 and that issue with the Atlas V. One of the solutions that Elon Musk came up with was ultimately retiring the family of Atlas Vs and switching over to a Falcon family. What's your reaction to that? Is that something that's feasible? Is that something that is on the horizon? Is DOD interested in that?
don't know. I have for you.
Yeah, I think the technologies are out there. I think one of the challenges you face, and I'll kind of speak just generally to this, that I think one of the challenges you face if you're looking at the DoD market from a commercial perspective is how do you keep your costs low enough that work well selling to another corporation or non-government customer and deal with one of the most bureaucratic and red tape strewn organizations we've probably ever seen in this country. DoD prizes mission assurance and pays for it. And so there is a business model built around that. And I think that's one of the big challenges when you're inside the Air Force or in GAO or anywhere looking at some of these options and trying to understand where do I get my best value. And I think that debate's happening because of the Russian situation and the reexamination of that relationship, but also the squeeze that people are feeling in procurement departments throughout the DoD.
Yeah, what plays against us is our great success that we've had on heavy launch. So who's going to be the first one to raise their hand and go, hey, I'm ready to step away and try something else? It will take someone bold. It will take a consortium of folks that want to be bold and actually give the commercial sector a chance to play in the game. And I think it's going to take a part of DoD to relook, the risk they're willing to take for mission assurance. If you're not willing to relook that, then you're going to be trapped, I think, always with very, very high costs there because of what you're going to demand as far as getting that expensive payload, no matter how big or small it is, up there in orbit.
Well, I think we've kind of laid out here it's a security issue as well, and maybe you can kill two birds with one stone. Compete it out, do it cheaper, do it here in the United States. And so we're not reliant on a foreign source for something that's of national security concern, and you can maybe even do it better. So, I mean, we've done that before in other areas. I think we could do it here. Another question. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am, over here. Go ahead.
Not a question, more of a contrarian.
Sure, wait for the mic here.
Thank you. Yes, contrarian comment, not question. So the point made about Crimea, it's great to have something that elevates the issue to the forefront in terms of procurement and supply chain security, but isn't this something DoD should be looking at generally and not having sole suppliers for critically dependent products?
I don't think you get any argument from anybody sitting up
here. I mean, but is this something that is just, how to leverage this? How can it actually be leveraged programming?
Sure.
I hate to say it, but the world is made up of bright, shiny objects, and this one happens to be the one we're all focused on. So how do you then play off that bright, shiny object, which is the lockdown of the Crimean Peninsula and the fact that, this ties right very nicely into our industrial base, our technology and whatnot. So it's going to take folks that are willing to continue to have the conversation and continue to drive forward with the idea that, we need to, relook, how we're doing our business there. I will, again, tell you from just witnessing as the Air Force is going through its space game that has all the services involved and certainly a lot of focus from across DoD and other sectors of the commercial world out there. There's lots of discussion as far as how do we make ourselves more dependent and less reliant on others out there to do our business in the future there.
To that, that's a great question. And I think ultimately you're talking about assumptions. When a program starts in government, it is based around certain assumptions. The world does change sometimes quickly. And I think that's one of the big abiding challenges is finding a procurement system, finding policies within DoD that can keep pace with the way the world actually is, not as we kind of wish it was or will be.
General Sipe nailed it. There's a lot of bright, shiny objects, and which one's shining today, which one's got above the fold on the post this morning type of thing. And that's part of the reason ASP has picked this up, is we said, hey, we think this is a vulnerability that we can fix. But getting any attention on the Hill is almost impossible on any given day. But now this one's pretty forefront, especially with, and that's what's brought it up, is the Crimea and the whole business in Russia and the sanctions. And then who are the sanctions? You get the drift on this. And then it's now a topic du jour. But we think it's a national security issue topic du jour. And that's why we picked it up and kind of run with it. And I think we will stick with this issue even. We have not covered it before. So it's a new one and a good one for us. Does that answer your question? Yes, sir, over here on the right side.
Thanks, Steve. If I can return again to push a little harder on the grand strategy dilemmas that are involved here in this field, how is it playing out? I mean, we have it in the cyber field also, where one school of thought says, let's put our resources, intellectual and other resources, into reducing our vulnerability, defense against cyber aggression. There's another school of thought, and they're not necessarily different people, who push for a robust offensive cyber capability, offensive capability. It appears to me that this also is characteristic of the field that we're talking about now, of space security. One way is to deal with it, is to reduce vulnerabilities, dispersal, other kinds of defensive mechanisms that you're talking about. And the other one, which is much more controversial, obviously, is to have a robust anti-satellite capability ourselves. And I wonder if you could characterize how this is playing out. Is there a push within the Pentagon, within the national security community, for that more controversial response, or is that being pushed aside?
Yeah, as a retired fighter pilot, I just don't get included in any of those type of discussions, nor are those discussions normally unclassified as far as for our own consumption out there. I have to think that we're smart enough that we need that there is an ongoing debate. And just as we've watched the whole idea about using space evolve over time and grow as far as how we're going to use it defensively, you know, I'm sure we're thinking offensively, even though we have not, you know, come forward with any type of doctrine that says we're going to go offensive there. But the fact that we're playing through those and thinking through those, I got to think the same thing's going on with cyber and all these other type of emerging asymmetric threats out there or capabilities that, you know, might take away our previous advantages there.
I think, too, you have to look, there's a technological track and there's a legal track. And I think they both will have times when they're advancing it out of step with each other, and that's probably where we are now. I think, you know, what is possible is, again, more in the realm of the classified world. I think to look at the vulnerability side of it is often where the understanding starts, and that sort of shared vulnerability is something that is universal to any user of space, whether it's a commercial entity or a nation state. And I think the rules that we've set up around that are fairly weak. I mean, it's not the kind of thing I think that you would see a nation that was intent on establishing an immediate advantage over, for say, the U.S., for example, would let that keep them from doing so discreetly, because the opportunity when everyone else is maybe abiding by a set of normative standards even is just so great.
You know, Sam, I think the bottom line to this is we don't know exactly, to answer your question. However, there are a lot of people over there that were certainly equally as smart as me, or if not considerably a bit more, and who are looking at all those issues. But they overlap, like August just said, on the legal side as well. So I think they're all considering those, but I don't know specifically what they are. Right behind you, Sam, there's...
Thanks, Mr. Stephen. Ahmed from the Egyptian Embassy. I just wondered if I could say that the United States strategy or new strategy towards the space and the cyber could, with all of the demands of money and all of these things, could such affect the United States foreign policy for their allies, like we could see in the past time that the release of the soldiers in the United States Army, and they decreased the aid for many of the allies, and something like that could affect the new strategy of the United States for dealing with their allies in the coming period. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the technological boundaries that we establish for our military will be things that our allies look to as either desiring themselves, and I think capability becomes part of that relationship. I think when you look at alliances and the notion of interoperability, and General Sipe can probably talk to this, you know, there is this other element to some of what we've discussed that hasn't been broached, but space has its own interoperability requirements in a war fighting or a simmering conflict type situation. that we also have to get our heads around, and that's both operational, legal, as well as practical.
Yeah, I can't add to that, August. Thanks.
Yeah, when you talk about, for instance, selling weapon systems to other countries, one of the beauty of that, of selling them to allies, is that you're compatible, and so you can talk, and you can maintenance-wise be interoperable. It just makes it that much better, that much easier. So, you know, the closer we work with allies, the better. The more cooperation we have, certainly, it's better. It's better for our defense establishment. So, you know, again, we have to keep ourselves secure, but nonetheless, we have to work with our allies as well. So, if we can facilitate that, so much the better.
I mean, I think just to add quickly, cyber is a test case because that as an exportable capability has a lot of interest, and yet there are national level, let alone international rules that govern those sorts of technologies, both within our allied sphere and our kind of further allied sphere, that make it very complicated to do so, let alone just giving up the keys to the house, so to speak, because some of those technologies take a long time and a lot of money to develop.
You bet. Does that answer your question? Anybody else? We get a closing question here from anybody? Or we have worn this subject out. I think it's a fascinating subject. ASP is not going to let this one go. We're going to track it certainly for the rest of this year, now that it's really come to light after the Crimea business, and we'll watch what happens with the RD-180. And then my understanding is there's a pool of maybe four engines or so left to do launches through perhaps 2015. After that, we've got to buy more either from the Russians or somebody else. So it's very curious to see how all that's going to play out, and we're very interested in that as well. But I appreciate you coming. We'll have this up on our website this afternoon. Keep up on our events on the website. We're adding them on very, very quickly these days. We're averaging about 2 to 3 a week. And I really appreciate you coming today. These have been great comments, great questions. Let's give our two panelists a big hand. Thanks.